And tonight's program constitutes my observation of the historical lessons of D-Day. I certainly, in talking about the bleak prospects for humanity and the reemergence of fascism, not only in Germany but elsewhere, this is in no way to dump on the sacrifices or to belittle the sacrifices of those who were involved in the Normandy invasion. It should also be noted from an historical standpoint that the Normandy invasion was not the turning point of World War II. That happened on the Eastern Front with the battles of Stalingrad and Kursk, something one never hears about. And again, this is not to belittle the sacrifices of those involved in the Normandy invasion. But in understanding history, the vast bulk of the fighting in Europe was carried by the Red Army on the Eastern Front. And indeed, those heroes involved with the Normandy invasion are very lucky that that was the case. Because, for example, if the 100 German divisions that were decimated at the Battle of Kursk had not been decimated at the Battle of Kursk, a lot of them would have been there on Omaha and Utah and Sword and Gold and Juno. And there'd be an awful lot of those veterans who were observing the 50th anniversary who would have achieved room temperature on June 6th, 1944. The Germany Alert newsletter of Tuesday, June 7th, has a great many fascinating articles, and we're going to be accessing just about the entire Germany Alert newsletter. But first, let me tell you where to get it. Germany Alert is a one-page newsletter which is published when they can publish it. It is supported by a number of very fine journalists, and Jay Mueller, a very talented and very intellectually aware German rap musician, provides much of the financing for the newsletter from the proceeds from his recording career. Germany Alert deserves and needs the support of all of those who truly are opposed to fascism, whether it's fascism in America, Germany, Italy, or elsewhere. Germany Alert can be contacted. First of all, their address is at 244 Madison Avenue, 244 Madison Avenue, Suite 191, New York, New York, 10016. 244 Madison Avenue, Suite 191, New York, New York, 10016. Now, Germany Alert can also be contacted. They have an 800, a fax number. It's 800-709-9458. 800-709-9458. And their email number via CompuServe is 100265, 3013. Once again, their email number is 100265, 3013. That's available through CompuServe. And you can contact Germany Alert about getting a subscription, and I strongly encourage people to do that because there's a lot of fabulous information coming out in Germany Alert that is not making it into the American press. And among the things that is not making it into the American press is the following. The Germans also observed D-Day. Of course, they, as reported on this broadcast and elsewhere, were very upset that the Allies were celebrating D-Day and that they did not invite the Germans. So the Germans also observed D-Day. From the Germany Alert newsletter of Tuesday, June 7th of 1994, we find the following small but very important item in the briefing section. Kohl, of course, that's Chancellor Helmut Kohl. Kohl perverted D-Day to announce that Germany and France will build a joint navy. It is to start operations in December and signal a merger within 5 years. The announcement, confirmed by Mitterrand's staff, of course that's French President François Mitterrand, means that France is once again militarily in the grip of Germany as it was under Pétain 50 years ago. Aides had demanded that Kohl avenge the Allied ceremonies in France, and he told one, quote, "While they celebrate the past, we will announce the future," unquote. Amen. Boy, they're doing that. The Jeremiah O'Brien and the other ships that gathered in memory of the huge Normandy invasion fleet have a counterpart that we're not hearing about. We heard all about the Jeremiah O'Brien. Of course, that is a San Francisco-based Liberty ship, which was actually part of the Normandy invasion fleet, and it was refitted, and actually had some of its original crew, and it sailed over there. There was a lot of publicity in the Bay Area, and there was a lot of publicity about the flotilla, which was anchored off of the Normandy beachhead and to observe the celebration of D-Day. But what we didn't hear was, as quite correctly reported here by Germany Alert, that once again, France is militarily in the grip of Germany. And a far more important naval development was taking place with far less publicity in the United States, namely the announcement that France and Germany are going to build a joint navy, and that within 5 years, their navies will be united. And as Cole said, while they celebrate the past, we will announce the future. Indeed, the relationship between the past and the future is something that I focus very heavily on in these broadcasts, and through the dissemination of the archives, it's an important relationship that I hope to highlight with the work that I do, because it is my conviction that an understanding of the connection between the past and the present is the only way to understand and positively affect the future. Ironies in connection with D-Day are quite plentiful, certainly the irony of having Helmut Kohl announced the future while the Allies were celebrating the past is matched by the following. And the historical background to this particular irony in many ways serves to illustrate the historical forces that have made it possible for Germany to not only reemerge as a fascist power, which it is doing, but to reemerge with almost no publicity in the countries where the publicity needs to be achieved. And indeed, the reinstitution of fascist elements at every level in Germany, which I've looked at in, among other broadcasts, Radio Free America number 2, and also the numerous installments of Radio Free America number 37 from the fall of 1992, specifically the September 13th, 20th, 27th, and October 4th of 1992 installments of Radio Free America 37 deal with the reinstitution of fascism in Germany at the end of World War II. Another very ironic aspect of the D-Day situation was reported in the San Francisco Examiner of Saturday, May 28th of 1994. This is an article by David Eisenstadt of the Examiner Washington Bureau, his last name Eisenstadt. It's Stateline Washington, and it's headlined, Irony of D-Day for Top U.S. General. This is something we've discussed before. In an irony of history, Army General John Shalikashvili, Shalikashvili, the nation's top-ranking military officer, will stand on Normandy's beaches June 6th, just miles from where his father, fighting with a Nazi-organized unit, battled the Allied D-Day invaders 50 years ago. Shalikashvili, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, will accompany President Clinton on an 8-day European trip to celebrate the valor and sacrifices of those who fought in World War II. When the general takes part in the D-Day commemoration events before thousands of Allied veterans at Normandy, he will be 6 miles from a French village where his father Dmitri fought Allied forces. In June of 1944, Dmitri Shalikashvili was a mid-level officer in a German battalion of ethnic Georgians. Later, he joined the Waffen-SS. Well, I've spoken about the fascist and Nazi background of John Shalikashvili's father. Whether or not it holds any significance for the policies of John Shalikashvili remains to be determined. No individual should be judged by his lineage, certainly. Yet at the same time, given the ideological fervor of people involved with the SS, including some of the Eastern European fascists who were involved with it, like Dmitri Shalikashvili, the possibility that the fascist viewpoints which his father was willing to fight for may have been passed on to the son is not one that should be too lightly dismissed under the circumstances. Whether or not Shalikashvili takes after dear old dad, certainly the irony of his participating in the Normandy invasion when his father was fighting the Allies is a considerable irony. And beyond that, the importation of the Shalikashvili family into the United States in many ways serves to denote one of the very critical elements in understanding not only the past, but also the present and the future, namely the fact that fascism was not an accident. It was not produced by Hitler and Mussolini hypnotizing everybody until they all went crazy. Rather, fascism was a militant, repressive, anti-communist system which was favored by many of the most powerful elements in the world, including and especially many influential industrialists and financiers in the United States and elsewhere. And because of the anti-labor and anti-communist stance of fascism, fascism was viewed with great favor with many of the dominant political elements in the country at that time and at this time. One of the offshoots of the favor with which fascism was regarded was the importation of the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit at the end of World War II. Gehlen, of course, one of the central focal points of this broadcast, was Hitler's Eastern Front intelligence chief during World War II. He headed up the Nazi Eastern Front intelligence organization Fremde Heere Ost, or Foreign Armies East. At the end of the war, Galen's organization was glommed onto the fledgling CIA. It became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. It became the de facto NATO intelligence organization. And finally, when the Federal Republic of Germany was incorporated, the Galen organization became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service, now the German Intelligence Service, while continuing to supply both the United States and NATO with the vast bulk of its intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, much of which was deliberately falsified to intensify the Cold War. It should be noted that the Galen organization and its incorporation into the American National Security Establishment paved the way for thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans to move up not only into the American National Security Establishment, but through the Crusade for Freedom, an enormously well-financed CIA domestic media operation in 1952. The Galen organization was able to place many people, particularly Eastern European fascists, in key positions within some of the ethnic blocs in the United States. Beyond that, as a result of the Crusade for Freedom, one of the central ideological components of the Galen organization from a methodological standpoint, namely rollback or liberation theory, a theory of waging the Cold War, which had its genesis with Alfred Rosenberg's Ostministerium and which involved the co-opting of the dissident ethnic Soviet minorities to the service of fascism or later the West in the Cold War, in order to enlist their services to not only defeat Soviet communism, but also to ultimately effect the breakup of the Soviet Union into its constituent ethnic republics, which were viewed by Hitler as prospective colonies, and which I suspect are viewed both by Hitler's descendants in Germany and his admirers in the United States in a similar fashion. Rollback or liberation theory, its genesis and results was described at great length in Radio Free America program number 37, specifically in the August 23rd, 1992 installment of Radio Free America 37. Interestingly enough, the Shalakashvili family came to the United States in 1952. Rollback or liberation theory, again, which had its genesis with the Ostministerium of the Third Reich, became a dominant American political and national security force as a result of the CFF. It had its triumph in the United States as a result of the assassination of John Kennedy. It saw its fulfillment in the 1980s and 1990s under Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Ronald Reagan, ironically enough, got his start in political life as a spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom. The pattern of the Central Intelligence Agency using the residua of the National Security Establishment of the Third Reich is unfortunately a very common one and has had all sorts of disastrous results. Another echo of that phenomenon this past week, to be viewed perhaps in the light of the enormous sacrifice of American fighting men in World War II, this echo was carried in the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, June 8th of 1994. By the way, the first two articles, one once again from the Germany Alert of June 7th, and the other article from the San Francisco Examiner of Saturday, May 28th. This article, again, from the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, June 8th, is an AP story datelined Washington and headlined, CIA denies it protected accused Nazi. It reads, the CIA denied a report that it shielded from prosecution a former Nazi officer accused of ordering the murder of 86 American prisoners of war in Belgium in 1944. The accused man, retired General Wilhelm Mohnke, 83, is living in Western Germany and is on the Justice Department's list of suspected Nazi war criminals barred from entry to the United States. He also was wanted for war crimes by Britain and Canada. The ABC show Day One reported Monday that Mohnke, M-O-H-N-K-E, provided information to the CIA after his release from prison in the former Soviet Union in 1955, and in exchange, the CIA gave him an unspecified sum of money and a guarantee that he would not be prosecuted for alleged involvement in World War II atrocities. Well, I'm in no position to comment directly on whether or not, as charged by Day One, the CIA protected Wilhelm Mohnke from prosecution because of his assistance against the Soviet Union in the Cold War. But certainly whether or not that allegation is true, a great many other individuals as heinous or even more so than Wilhelm Mohnke are, as a matter of public record, known to have been not only freed from prosecution, but incorporated into the services of the Galen organization and through them, the CIA. I would also note that whether or not the allegation by Day One is true, denials on such matters by the CIA are pro forma and consequently worthless from an objective informational standpoint. Another echo of that very same phenomenon, the incorporation of the residual of the Third Reich at the end of World War II, the seeds of Nuremberg. And frankly, as we have seen in the past, the Nuremberg trials were something of a farce, although a few of the more obvious and obnoxious elements of Nazism were removed. Nuremberg was basically something of a cover-up, sort of a huge international Warren Commission, which in order to incorporate or in order to enlist the anti-communist services of the Third Reich, saw to it that the denazification edict was basically gutted. We are seeing now in the former Yugoslavia a manifestation of the resurgent forces of fascism in Europe. And one of the echoes that goes from the past to the present was discussed in the New York Times op-ed page of Tuesday, May 24th of 1994. This is a column by A.M. Rosenthal, New York Times columnist, and it concerns Kurt Waldheim, former German intelligence officer, an individual involved in the brutal anti-partisan campaigns in the former Yugoslavia, and also apparently involved in aspects of the liquidation of European Jewry. Skipping down, talking of a Professor Hertzstein, who has written a book called Waldheim, The Missing Years, Rosenthal says, Professor Hertzstein, author of, quote, Waldheim, The Missing Years, unquote, is working on another book about the concealment of the Waldheim past. He also has a new biography out of Henry R. Luce. After years of investigation, Professor Hertzstein says Mr. Waldheim, quote, was protected by the U.S. government, provided information in return for that protection, and profited from the government's willingness to obliterate his wartime service, unquote. Now, his purpose in giving me the, quote, assessments, unquote, above, which he got from the State Department, is to try to focus congressional attention on opening the more important and still closed Waldheim files of the CIA. Professor Hertzstein and the New York Times are considering legal action to overturn CIA refusals, but he thinks it urgent that Congress itself pass legislation preventing government agencies from denying information about World War II war crimes. Myself, I think passing such legislation would be the best way, productive and revealing, for members of Congress to show they do indeed remember Kurt Waldheim. Well, I think that the New York Times editors and staff columnists should do what they can to reveal the forces of fascism, yet in light of the New York Times sponsorship of such travesties as the Warren Report, which not only helped to cover up the murder of an American president, but in so doing helped to obscure the actions of many of the Galen-related contemporaries and associates of people like Kurt Waldheim. I think the New York Times bears a serious measure of guilt in helping to perpetuate the very forces that Mr. Rosenthal is clucking his tongue at under the circumstances. Now, in the past, we have taken a look at Kurt Waldheim and his connections to elements involved with U.S. intelligence, specifically in an article from, interestingly enough, the New York Times back in 1986. It was disclosed that Kurt Waldheim got his first job with the Austrian government, with the Interior Ministry, as I recall, but I'm acting from memory, so I may be wrong in that detail. But he got his first job with the Austrian government as a result of the good offices of a fellow named Fritz Molden, M-O-L-D-E-N. Fritz Molden was an operative of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency. He also was the son-in-law of Alan Dulles, one of the key operatives of the OSS, one of the individuals who helped to effect the Christian West negotiations, clandestine World War II negotiations with the elements of the Third Reich, to effect basically a marriage of a Hitlerless Reich with the other Western powers in an anti-Soviet alliance. As we looked at in the August 9th, 1992 installment of Radio Free America 37, the Christian West concept was a Third Reich contingency plan to survive military defeat. It was successful. A Hitlerless Reich, basically a non-denazified Germany, non-denazified in good measure as the result of the work of people like Alan Dulles, as the new book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, by Christopher Simpson documents. The Hitlerless Reich was basically incorporated with the other Western powers into NATO, as we saw in the 8-9-92 installment of Radio Free America 37. NATO basically is the manifestation of the Christian West. And we should note the Fritz Molden-Dulles-Waldheim connection. I would also note that Kurt Waldheim's infamy with regard to his activities in Yugoslavia were in regard to his role as an intelligence officer in Operation Schwarz. That was the German military operation at the Sucheska River when they attempted to obliterate the Yugoslavian partisans. This operation was aimed at eliminating the Yugoslavian partisans in World War II so that the 100,000 German troops that were pinned down in Yugoslavia could be freed up for Operation Citadel, the huge German campaign against the Kursk salient on the Eastern Front. That campaign was ultimately, that campaign resulted in the Battle of Kursk, the largest armored battle in history, and that was the real turning point in World War II, not D-Day, or at least the real turning point in the European theater. And this is in no way, by the way, once again, to detract from the heroism and sacrifice of those who fought in the Normandy invasion. On the contrary, I share the degree of gratitude that has already been expressed on the part of many to those participants for their sacrifice. However, I am doing what I'm doing to note that that sacrifice bought us time and nothing more. Fascism was not defeated. It was delayed, and unfortunately, while the GIs and the airmen and the sailors were dying, and the British Tommies and the Canadian soldiers were fighting and dying, as well as the Résistants, in and around Normandy, there were people seeking to bring the likes of Dmitry Shalakashvili into the United States. There were people like Alan Dulles seeking to obtain the services of the Kurt Waldheims of the world, and unfortunately, they were only too successful, and those seeds of Nuremberg, as I have called them, are bearing fruit. They are sprouting. So note that Kurt Waldheim was actually involved in Operation Schwarz, the encirclement at the Sucheska, a very good account of that, by the way, by a former leader of the World War II Yugoslavian partisans who later became one of the most prominent critics of Tito's post-war regime. That man is known as Milovan, is not known as. His name is Milovan Gilas, last name D-J-I-L-A-S. Look for his book, Wartime. Wartime by Milovan Gilas. There's a hardcover edition by Harcourt Brace Jovanovic. It's an excellent account of the fighting in Yugoslavia during World War II. And in particular, one of the central elements in that is his account of Operation Schwarz, the encirclement at the Sucheska, the operation that Kurt Waldheim was involved in, and which involved as its central element the brutal Waffen-SS Mountain Division, the Prinz-Eugen Division. As we've looked at in, among other broadcasts, Radio Free America program number 36 about the destabilization of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, many of those same Galen-related elements, elements associated with the Reinhard Galen organization, elements that had been involved in the fascist coalition that fought alongside of the Third Reich, Croatia and Slovakia as independent, quote, republics, as, quote, independent republics, unquote, as well as the nations of Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and for a time Finland, fought alongside of Nazi Germany in World War II. The Croatian fascists, the Ustashi, supported by the Vatican among others, formed a principal element of the Galen-related liberation milieu that I spoke about in Radio Free America number 36 and 37. Indeed, the Ustashi, as much or more than any other of the fascist groups in World War II, remained intact, remained cohesive, and with the destabilization of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, they were able to return to power in the now independent Croatia once again. That's not to say that all Croatian nationalists are fascists, but one cannot separate out Croatian nationalism from its fascist past. And indeed, in a Germany Alert, an edition of the Germany Alert newsletter that I read to you last summer, we talked about something which has now received a lot of press, namely the fact that the new, quote, democratic, unquote, Croatia, note the quotes, has reinstituted the currency that it used during the fascist period. Speaking of the Croatian currency, and by the way, the reinstitution of the fascist Ustashi elements in Yugoslavia has been discussed in numerous broadcasts, including Radio Free America 36 and 37. The following, and there were many, many accounts of this, by the way. I'm sure many of you have heard of this or seen it. This is from the New York Times of Saturday, May 28th of 1994. The wartime currency of the Ustashi was called, the Ustashi regime was called the Kuna. It has now been reinstituted. This article is called Croatia Currency's Name Protested. It's by Roger Cohen, special to the New York Times, Dateline Zagreb, Croatia, May 26th, that reads in part as follows. In a move that has set off protest, the government of President Franjo Tudjman has decided to rename the Croatian currency after that used by the pro-Nazi puppet regime in Croatia in World War II. Starting on Monday, the dinar, which was the monetary unit in the former Yugoslavia, will be replaced by the kuna, K-U-N-A, previously used as the national currency under the fascist Ustashi government of Ante Pavlic, P-A-V-E-L-I-C. The new kuna will be valued at about 17 cents, and the notes will carry the portraits of Croatian heroes and martyrs, many from the Middle Ages. The revival of the kuna, the word is Croatian for marten, a small forest animal with a valuable fur, has brought strong protests from Croatia's Serbs and Jews, both of whose groups were massacred in large numbers by the Ustashi between 1941 and 1945. Skipping down. Milan Djukic, D-J-U-K-I-C, the leader of the minority Serbian party in Croatia, has also expressed anger, calling the return of the kuna a hurtful reminder to Serbs of their slaughter under the Ustashi, as well as a foolish step at a time when Serbs in Serbian-occupied parts of Croatia maintain that they would otherwise be vulnerable to a repeat of history. And skipping down once again, we'll call it quits on that article at that point. Again, last summer, the Germany Alert newsletter announced what has now been confirmed by the mainstream press, namely that the new, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia is going to reinstitute the currency from its fascist period. And indeed, a number of other things from the fascist period have been reinstituted to a large extent. Germany had a great deal to do with the fracturing of the Yugoslavian Union and the precipitation of the bloodshed which is currently bedeviling that region. Indeed, once Croatia became independent as a result of German, European, and American pressure, and once the Ustashi elements, which had been nurtured within the bosom of not only the non-denazified Germany, but the Galen Spy organization and the very closely related anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, a key element of the former World Anti-Communist League, itself directly evolved from Adolf Hitler's Committee of Subjugated Nations, formed in 1943. Once those elements returned to Yugoslavia, the fracturing of the Yugoslavian Union and the resulting bloodshed became inevitable. Indeed, in an addendum to Radio Free America 36 that I did last summer, reading from Covert Action Information Bulletin, the role of Germany in the destabilization of Yugoslavia is worth noting. The debate continued, really should not be a debate, but the debate about the degree of guilt borne by the fascists of World War II for what they did continues to be bandied about, and just as there are people attempting to deny Hitler's liquidation of the Jews, there are those who are maintaining that what actually occurred in Yugoslavia did not occur. A letter to the New York Times on May 12th of 1994. By the way, that last story from the New York Times of May 28th of 1994. The New York Times of May 12th of this year had an interesting letter from a Nils Horner from New York. He writes to the editor, Serbia's suffering in Holocaust is exaggerated. Letter April 29th by C. Michael McAdams is a slap in the face not only to the memory of the Serbs and Gypsies, who perished in the Nazi puppet state of Croatia in World War II, but also to those who think one should look at history objectively and truthfully. Contrary to Mr. McAdams, the process of exterminating Serbs in World War II Croatia is not, quote, ancient fiction, unquote. It was judged at Nuremberg to have amounted to genocide. According to Professor Fred Singleton in, quote, A Short History of the Yugoslav Peoples, unquote, Cambridge, England, 1985, the behavior of the Croatian Ustasha shocked even Hitler's SS. Mr. Singleton quotes a February 1942 German security police report, quote, The Ustasha units have carried out their atrocities not only against Eastern Orthodox males of military age, but in particular in the most bestial fashion against unarmed old men, women, and children. Innumerable Orthodox have fled to Rump, Serbia, and their reports have roused the Serbian population to great indignation, unquote. According to Professor Singleton, the leader of World War II Croatia, Ante Pavlic, was able to, quote, wreak havoc on the Serbian population and to dishonor the name of Croatia by the appalling atrocities for which his regime became notorious, unquote. By the way, I would recommend two people, among other books, to find out about the Ustashi Blowback, by Christopher Simpson, hardbound edition, Weidenfeld and Nicholson. The book Inside the League by John Lee and Scott Anderson. Also Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America by Howard Blum. Those are books that I've dealt with in various archive shows. They go into the Croatian Ustashi, what they did and how many of those criminals were perpetuated within the bowels of the U.S. and German post-World War II national security establishments.